This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
I'm Andrew Weinstein. I will be your guest moderator and just helping out our featured speaker today. We're very fortunate to have Kent Anderson. He's CEO and publisher of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and he's going to be talking about his experiences with new models for increasing reach and monetizing digital content. And at the end of his presentation, we'll reserve time for questions. If you do have questions, would you mind please going to the center where the microphone is so that everybody can hear them? And with that, Ken.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. You chose wisely. This is a great session. So I'll just raise your expectations now and hope I exceed them. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening. My name is Kent Anderson. I'm CEO, publisher of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and I was asked to talk about how to keep digital content, in this case the content that we present in journals, free from becoming archaeological relics or artifacts that people discover later, dust them off, and think, what an odd, quirky civilization that this must have been. Career has spanned more than 20 years. I've worked with some of the better brands in medical journal publishing, pediatrics. I was about 10 years at New England Journal of Medicine, first as the publishing director and then as the head of product development. Now work at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. I'm on the AMA, Journal Oversight Committee, and I run a little blog called The Scholarly Kitchen. And I'm the president-elect of the Society for Scholarly Publishing. So I know this stuff pretty well, and throughout my 20 years, one thing has held true is that medical publishing and publishing in general has become more complex and complicated. One of the things in medicine that's driving this complication, a way to deal with it, is to come up with clinical practice guidelines, boil down all the information into simple step-by-step instructions. And you go back into the history of medicine and you can see some of these early ones. For instance, this is one of the first flow charts. Are you of noble birth? Yes. You die by gout? No. You die by plague. Now, this seems ridiculous, and it is quite funny, but you go forward to just 175 years ago, and this is what happens when you get a cold like the one I'm fighting. You have 12 leeches put onto your chest. You're given extract of hyoscyamus. You're giving my favorite word of all time, mucilaginous beverages. Just imagine how that feels going down. And if you're pregnant, you get to wait a day while your friend gets the leeches applied to her chest because they want to see how she does before they imperil the life of the baby. There's absolutely no scientific underpinning to any of this practice because they thought leeches were sucking the poisons out of the body. What were they doing, in fact, but injecting blood thinners? And this was actually a very unpleasant way of taking two aspirins and calling me in the morning. So 175 years of looking at journals as bound generic printed content read under reflected light. But over the past 10 years, the journal has become much more abstracted. It now holds data elements. It has audio. It has video. Many more inputs, and the reader itself has become abstracted as well. We have Google indexing all of our content. We have social networks forwarding it actively. We have email. We have audio players. We have it on Kindle. And so you have this more diverse ecosystem, but more interestingly, you have this more interesting interaction, and a lot of my talk is going to be about why that interaction is so important to monetizing content going forward, and that's really the sweet spot. Our cultural project as academic publishers is to make knowledge available to nonlinear access in as many ways as possible. The networked world is a great aid in our goal because you don't have to go through intermediaries anymore. You can go through your friends. And so you see this evolution of publishing that's very, very compatible with our ultimate goal. You see the priests controlling it, forcing it as a producer onto the consumers with their very particular way of viewing the world. Then, of course, they outsourced it because they didn't want to do all the work, so they got Scriptori to do it. And then you got the bulk publishing model of making many, many copies, and then Web 1.0, which was making many, many copies available. And finally, Web 2.0, where all of a sudden consumers and producers become somewhat interchangeable. And each can take on the role of the other in certain parts of life. And so you have intermediation, which would be a linear process, replaced by apomediation, where instead of people interposing themselves between you and what you want, you have people who guide you, and they gain value because they guide you. These are the people who write the Amazon reviews, or who are librarians more commonly are not gatekeepers anymore of information, but intellectual partners as you find your way to information. So you see that this change as knowledge becomes more and more nonlinear. Another is heterarchy, where hierarchies, where you would have to go, remember Yahoo back in the early days, you had to drill down through all these file systems to get to what you wanted. Now you have the heterarchy of Google, where if I'm in the UK and I Google something, it's different than when I Google it in Germany or when I Google in the United States or when I Google it 3 hours later. You have a system replete with overlap, multiplicity, mixed ascendancy. You can have hierarchies in that. The list is ordered, but ultimately it's part of a heterarchy. Okay, so those are two concepts we'll see appear again and again in this talk. And you see a complete change between the past and the future. What was analog, what was delayed, it took a long time to get out, which was tethered and tied to the medium, which you used in isolation generally, where the copies were generic, my copy and your copy were the same, where consumption was the primary mode, it was a primarily closed system. And why was it? Well, it just evolved that way. Now you have a system that's digital, immediate, mobile, connected, much more personal, a balance of creation and consumption, a balance of open and closed, and much more highly engineered than it used to be. Is it a social revolution? Is it an industrial revolution? It's probably a little of both. So I'm going to take you through some examples of how this mix of changes in the people that we're serving and the tools that we're using to serve them can be used to your benefit, but it's all from a journal's perspective. So back in the late 1990s, the New England Journal of Medicine had something called an image challenge. And it was very simple. You looked at an image, you thought about what it was, and then you clicked, show me what it is, and it would show you. We decided to take a little bit of game theory to that. And so we made it so you could win a coffee mug if you guessed correctly. I wanted to take it farther than that, but this was version 1.0, and the editors weren't comfortable with taking it all the way to gaming. So they had this really inadvisable interaction model, which was, what's the diagnosis for this poor guy's retina? You would type it in, submit it, and a week later, somebody would go through the database, an editor, pick out the winner, email them that they've won a coffee mug, and not tell anybody else what happened. Obviously, this didn't work. So we went to version 2.0, where you get a multiple choice. And more interestingly, you get this button, how others chose. And you can click that right away, because it's so helpful. Oh, wait. Which one do you pick? Well, it looks like some people are guessing wrong. 17,000 answers, and you got a kind of a tie here. Well, I know the answer is onchocerciasis, so I pick that, and I'm correct. I can send it to a friend. I can look down in this gallery. And a simple change to this interaction model took it from 1,500 users per week, being generous, frankly, no customer buzz, to 30,000 users per week, being conservative. In 4 years, there were more than 12 million responses to this. Major buzz. It became the third most popular domain level in the site. Homepage, search, and image challenge were the top three. Went on to become an app, $2.99, sold thousands of copies, very popular, major feature. Okay. All right, now this one is one of my all-time favorite ways to monetize content. If you know of a better, more clever way to do it, I'd love to hear about it. Because how many of you have monetized your search box? All right, so we had a search box on the old site. We've since redesigned the site, or New England Journal of Medicine did. I'm no longer there. And it had a keyword citation or author search box. Let's enter the term diabetes. Looks like a perfectly normal search result, right? Ordered list, related searches. If you go behind the scenes, though, you can see this something called OP. And you notice the second search is OP130. OP stands for original position. That's the position that the algorithms wanted to slot that article based on keyword relevance, okay? But the search engine has another layer to it, which is those concentric circles out from the term diabetes, there are related terms, it checks all of those, the behavior within all of those, and within a week or two, it slots articles up higher based on their what the audience is saying as far as what they're clicking on those clustered terms. And so it drove very quickly this article up to the number two position. Okay, satisfaction with this search went through the roof, by the way, because people were saying, yep, that's exactly what I wanted. Another interesting thing is these related searches, initially populated by the search engine, but those were quickly replaced by what people were searching on. So very good ones, though, diabetes mellitus, exenatide, sitagliptin, type 2 diabetes. And the editors were always wondering, when's this thing going to show its flaws, because it's a machine. So they were very happy when this DCCT showed up. Aha, they said, your algorithm is foolish. Until we clicked on the article and looked and saw that DCCT was indeed the acronym for the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial. And we asked the endocrinologist, and they said, oh, yeah, that's its street name. People were saying, oh, yeah, DCCT is published in the New England Journal this week. So everybody was searching for it, finding it. So this was actually a very valid type of tag-related search, but not one that an editor would have put on, but one that a user would put on. So very different. So you're a publisher. You have a list of the articles that are the best results for diabetes, and your audience has voted it this way. What do you do with that? You make a publication out of it. And you sell this for a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And you do it in 8 specialties. And you more than pay for your search engine. And this has been still in production. They've been around for about 5 years. So that's one of my favorite little content monetization stories. You've got users who, without any interruption to their workflow, are actually enhancing their workflow later and paying it forward for others, but then also giving the publisher something they can use for themselves. Some other interactives that we did there. Clinical decisions. This was a way for the community to participate in talking about when new research appeared. In this case, a fictional but realistic case of a 30-year-old white woman with mild persistent asthma who'd been around the block as far as treatments and was kind of sick of the latest thing and didn't believe that she wanted to burden herself with that much. Here are 2 new studies about ways to treat mild persistent asthma. What do you do? You get 3 experts to each take a position on this. And then you get your community to cast their votes. Which one do you think you should do? You capture all those votes. You get 7,000 responses. You get all of these comments over here from places like Los Angeles, Madrid, Cairo. And then you compare between China, Canada, Brazil, Mexico. And then you bring those back in to the print publication in a summary form so that everybody can see how everybody's thinking. And again, that interaction between audience and publisher, there's a lot of synergy there. One of my favorite things that I did in my career was to introduce PowerPoint slide sets to medical journals. This was something that wasn't the norm at all 8 years ago, but is now pervasive. And the arguments that we had about this with the technologists, they said, you can just right-click, download an image, put it in a PowerPoint slide. That's not really a great service. And I said, okay, but we've got XML and we've got these image databases. We can just pull them together. Why don't we try it? We tried it. The audience loved it. Absolutely loved it. You can download slides that have the images in them. They're branded, a little bit of information about the citation and source. You can do tables. You can do figures. You can do whatever you want. How popular are these? In the first 2 years, more than 450,000 slide sets were downloaded just from New England Journal of Medicine. Through surveys, we found that each set was used 3 to 5 times before 10 to 15 people. This meant our slides were exposed to about 18 million people in 20 months. That's more than the print issue mailed in the same amount of time. There's a huge branding and information exchange. The other thing was these were so popular, we held them back just for individual subscribers. Journals sell to institutional markets and to individuals. Individuals would subscribe to New England Journal of Medicine just to get the PowerPoint slide sets. Because New England Journal of Medicine was a newsmaker, we created the infrastructure to cover the news as it happened. Within weeks of the H1N1 flu breaking out, we had an H1N1 influenza center up. As soon as the healthcare reform debate started up, within 2 weeks we had a healthcare reform center up. These are all built on WordPress. They were all very robust. These are the full screen captures. We've got an arc pulled from our archive. We've got polling tools, commenting tools, partnered with the CDC to get their Twitter feed, a special Twitter feed that they curated for us, an interactive map from Harvard School of Public Health, photo gallery, a blog, news, all those normal things that you would do, but very quickly and very different for a medical journal to think this way toward its audience so much. And other journals are doing the same thing. This is the Health Affairs blog. And blogs are wonderful ways to think on your feet, get some reaction, engage an audience, and be important. Videos were also extremely important. We started a feature, Videos in Clinical Medicine. In scholarly publishing, authors really need citations, so these had to be full articles so that they would be incentivized to publish with us. But these were full-on video productions with storyboards, chapters, closed captions, all the normal bells and whistles you expect from video, and an extremely popular feature. So, goodbye NEJM, hello JBJS. Orthopedic surgeons are very different from internal medicine and pediatric physicians, medical doctors. They're surgeons. And JBJS was a very different and still is a very different publication. When I got there, it was a company focused on producing a single product, the journal. And it had a great print legacy and a website that was very 1.0. And I didn't know orthopedic surgeons at all, but I knew that from a business standpoint, this organization to grow had to change from being the business of a journal to being a business with a journal. But I knew that I didn't know orthopedic surgeons. And neither did the company, it turns out. They were working with proxies for orthopedic surgeons, board members and editors, but those people were about two or three steps removed. And even when they were working with residents or working in their practices, they weren't looking at those things like anthropologists look at them. They were looking at them like people who work in them look at them, which is different. You aren't looking for the right things. So we worked with a company you might have heard of called IDEO. They do user-centered design. They're excellent. And what they look for are the extremes, the extreme non-users or the extreme heavy users. The extreme non-users inform you because they show you the big gaps. What is available? What aren't you doing? The extremely heavy users show you the use cases. Why are you useful to some people? What do they want more of? These people in the middle, too much of a mixed bag, low yield. So a few of us, myself, the chairman of our board of trustees, my editor-in-chief, my associate publisher, director of business development, director of marketing, spent eight weeks with IDEO going out to the market. We went to Iowa, New York, Boston, Maine, a number of other places. We had a little war room in IDEO. We prototyped all sorts of different things, stimulus concepts, and we went out into the field, and we were the anthropologists. We got to see how people organize information in stacks on your heater. And when we pointed out, this is how people don't realize what they're doing, we said, oh, so that's how you organize information. He said, I guess that is how I organize information. They don't even know it. You see how print and online interact. And when this person got up, what did she take with her? The phone and one folder. Those are the only important things that were portable. And you see what their workspaces are actually like. One center was very interesting. All of their monitors, or their orthopedic surgeons, right, all their monitors were vertical because they're doing a lot of imaging studies, and we tend to, at least bone-wise, be longer than we are wide. So they want to see a lot of femurs and humeri, I guess. And people don't always do what they say they do. So, please, no food, drink, or smoking, says the man with the pipe. This is in an orthopedic center. And you turn around, and there are the donuts, bagels, and coffee. Because there's no food, drink, or smoking. And at 8 a.m., and of course, orthopedic surgeons are really worried about obesity because that leads to all sorts of untoward consequences for your bones and joints. But by 9 a.m., just 1.5 lonely donuts left. So there's a lot of carb loading going on and a lot of caffeine. So people don't always do what they're saying they're going to do, and then you also get an interesting insight into the culture. I don't know if you can see this. This is a little wooden statuette of the orthopedic surgeon, complete with blood on the knife and blood on the smock. One of the most charming little things we found in our excursion. It was also interesting to go and interview people in the library there, because we would say, how many times have you been in the library that's provided by this medical center? I said, wow, first time. You know? So you realize that they really don't use the library. So a lot of insights. We learned that orthopedic surgeons are on a particular journey from theory to evidence, and they're on it repeatedly, and they're looking for high-yield trips, right? They don't want to go through that if it's not high-yield. We saw how our information fits into that, how they organize information, their personal interactions, how they, a lot of them had moved online. They were using a lot of tools like WebEx and Yahoo groups to interact with each other, and their basic concern was they didn't want to leave a record. They wanted to be able to have the private conversation at a distance and not worry about liability issues. So WebEx is great for that, because you turn it off and it's gone. And print and digital intersections. Where did they pick up print? Where did they pick up online? Where were they moving? And in 3 years, it had changed dramatically, because their employers had purchased the infrastructure for them. So we got a nice little roadmap from IDEO, and so we've made a number of changes based on this. So when I started, there was just the one product. The company focused on doing this product. And then we abstracted it a bit. Said, okay, let's take JBJS as a branding element and not a product name so much, and let's abstract it out. And lo and behold, we can have three products right away. It turns out surgeons, shockingly, like to read about surgical techniques. They also are very interested in cases. But there's something interesting that happens when you move into the digital world. You remove capacity concerns, and you improve connecting capabilities. So Case Connector is one of the more fascinating little products that we've launched. And I'll take you through it, because I'm a big fan of my own ideas. All right. So this is based on semantic technology. So now there's 3,000 orthopedic surgery cases going back to 1921 in Case Connector. Editorially, cases in medical journals are low man on the totem pole. They're filler. They have to be unique. They have to be well reported, or you're not going to put them in. And if, even when you do put them in, you tend to put them in kind of reluctantly. And at most of the journals I've worked at, their acceptance rate has been shockingly low, lower than even the scientific articles. And it's just because editors think not much of them. But users love them. So this is one of the great examples of editors not quite being on the side of their readers. But what we can do with, and have done with Case Connector, is said, okay, novelty is no longer a concern, because space is no longer a concern. And actually, these connections are much more interesting. So if we were to happen to get 5 cases from all over the world and they were reporting kind of the same thing, that would be really an early warning system, wouldn't it? And one of the things that's going on in orthopedics right now is metal on metal, hip. That's only becoming an issue because the cases are being reported. The same thing with autologous blood transfusions, and you know, Kobe Bryant gets his knee done and everybody's excited about that. So now all these cases, an orthopedic surgeon looking for high-yield content can come in and with 7 different semantic facets find cases that match exactly what they are doing on their journey from theory to evidence. Okay, so I can look at diseases and conditions, the anatomy, treatment and procedures, signs and symptoms, devices, patient demographics. So I can find cases from adolescent males having to do with bone plates and the distal femur. And I can find those with 4 clicks of the mouse, and there we go. We just did a survey. This launched about a year ago. We just did a survey. 80% of the people who have used it said they're starting to rely on it. They're definitely using it repeatedly. So that's great. The other thing that semantics have let us do is to identify our content with surgeons in a way that they think of themselves. They think of themselves as operating in different modes, and those modes have to do with parts of the body or specialties. So am I working on elbow? Am I working on hip? Am I working on knee? And they need the information there. And their practices tend to reflect that to some extent. Even in group practices, you know, almost every orthopedic surgeon has to work on trauma at some point. They tend to work on hip. And then they'll go maybe to one or two other joints. Maybe they'll be pediatric. But now we can unite our content effortlessly through semantic tagging. And not only that, but we can also put our advertisements that way. So I'll talk about that in a second. So what we have are these corridors. So this is the knee corridor. Has the knee surgery highlights in it. This is another set of publications I'll talk about in a minute. But all of the advertising is semantically targeted, including not only display ads from device companies and pharmaceutical companies, but jobs ads. The click-through rate on these semantically targeted ads, 2.6 to 4.0 times run of sight. So we charge a premium, and the advertisers get their value, and the customers get ads that actually make sense. So as I mentioned, we have these Orthopedic Highlights publications. We launched those about a year ago as well. These are literature surveillance tools. The other thing surgeons want, again, high yield information. So we'll have experts go through the literature and find the best studies and comment on them. And now we're able to sell our content in corridors, what we call corridors. So if you want to buy all the content across our publications just in trauma, you can do that by buying the trauma corridor. It's low priced. You get all the content from the scientific journal, from Case Connector, from Surgical Techniques, and from the Orthopedic Highlights in that area. These are selling pretty well, and people get it right away. They go, oh, got it. Get it. Good metaphor. Hold on. I have a prop. I almost forgot. All right. So one of the kind of throwaway ideas from IDEO, but we came across it and went, oh, maybe that's not such a throwaway idea, was the use of QR codes. Again, we were finding that, you remember that picture of the cell phone sitting on the desk? We were finding a lot of the orthopedic surgeons were picking up smartphones, like, you know, people in the higher income brackets are typically getting these iPads, iPhones earlier than everybody else, except for teenagers. And so there was this mock-up that they did of a perhaps new journal article with a QR code on it. And so we thought, well, we're having a hard time getting people over to our online-only content. Let's start putting QR codes in here because it has two functions. One, it has the function if you are using a smartphone and have a QR code reader, you can use it to pop up the content on your phone, and it's moderately well used for that. The other is it's really eye-catching, and it makes you really aware that there's something digital there. You can't mistake it for anything else. So the usage of these online-only things has gone up quite a bit because not only people are jumping over there using their devices, but it's a good marketing bug. And of course, I always bring my best ideas with me. So JBJS has its own image quiz, which is very similar to New England Journal's, and it has its own app, which just launched. And the cover has its own QR code promoting it, because print and online interactions are just fine and dandy. Thank you very much. And we're selling about, we had this issue just mailed, so it hasn't even reached anybody, but we're selling about 20 a day. So we're just at the early days for JBJS, but right now we've moved definitely beyond a single print product. We're moving to a more abstracted brand and audience centered environment for product development innovation. We're finding great ways by connecting our content through technology to monetize it. And I'm excited about what we're going to do next. We have a lot of things on the docket and many things to do. So I would be happy to take your questions because this is what we're trying to do. Thanks. Any questions, or was that clear as mud? Oh, can you go to the microphone?
Oh, sorry.
Right. Yes. Clinical decisions. Right. Right. Let me get back to the slide so I can.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yep. So this is, I think, where we start on this. So there were a number of things going on. This was started at a particularly dicey time for the world. Everybody was fighting, especially the Middle East was tense, and it still is. But first, the concern going in was that we would get garbage comments and we would regret ever doing this. And we got, I think, two comments we had to reject. One was because they were promoting a product and sort of trying to be subtle about it, but they weren't that subtle. And the other was a teenager. So, but what was remarkable is that here were all these physicians, and the editors were very impressed by this, all over the world, different time zones, everything else. And the poor people who had to moderate these, they were up at all hours because it was so addictive. They're just like, oh, that's another good comment. So they'd stay up, watch the Red Sox, and they watch the highlights. And then I got calls at like 11. Oh, my God, they're still coming in. But these physicians from all over the world would be on topic. They'd be very concerned about the patient. They'd be very concerned about what they wrote. They would be very accurate. And the polling tool over here just showed the general results, but behind the scenes it was parsing it out into a database. And so then all that the editors had to do at the end of it, because they've been soaking in it, was sort of, you know, write up their experience, go into the database, pull out some data, get some graphic designers to make a nice little thing, and they could publish it. But because they, you know, it's kind of a two-week period, we let these things, I think this was 3 weeks, we let these things stay up, then we would close it down, and then they'd write their summary. But by the end of the second, third week, they kind of knew what they were going to write, and they wanted to, because it was like, wow, this is such a great experience, and boy, it was fascinating, they knew all the ins and outs. So they learned what to write during the time period. I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was there was a lot. One of the things that we found by going into the multimedia directions and all these is that we had staff who had hidden skills. We had people who said, "Oh yeah, I did video about 5 years ago," or, you know, "Oh yeah, I've been learning Flash on the side," and so now one of the illustrators at NEJM, I can't say ours anymore since I'm not there, but one of the illustrators is this Flash guru. And, you know, he was a wonderful illustrator, but now he's this amazing interactive designer. And, you know, and no additional staff. He still do a nice drawing for you, but he just is, you know, so you find enthusiasms. Hi. You're right. So the two questions, one, can you track how deeply somebody reads into an article? The answer is no. Just how it is. Physicians, as you probably will confess, will tend to read the abstracts, and the content that's presented in professional journals is drillable content. You can go deeper if you want to, but a lot of times you don't. Again, high yield being a major concern. As far as CME, you can track how well they do. A lot of requirements are coming out for you to do so, and there to be pass-fail rates and a bar set so that you have to get so many right. But because CME is about learning and not about testing, most of those allow repetition, so you can go back and say, what did you get wrong? And in fact, one of the CME systems that I first helped build was would show you where in the article the right answer was, because again, it's about making sure you learn the point, not whether you get hit across the wrist. Okay. Sure. Happy to. So let's go to, I'll go do current, what we're doing currently. So we have, because we've tied together all of the JBJS publications in a semantic framework, we're able to put in the background behind the scenes a what we call JOIN. It's the JBJS Online Information Network. And that sells ads across the site, but they're semantically targeted. And just get this to a nice stopping point. Good enough. And again, so we are able to sell targeted advertising across all of these properties at a premium. We're able to sell targeted job ads at a premium. So we're migrating from, like everybody else on the advertising front, from print to online. And so we're able to get our CPMs up to an acceptable level. We still need more inventory because one of the tricks about print advertising versus online advertising is print advertising, there really is no inventory problem. Online, there is a definite cap to inventory. That's your traffic. But it's very easy to add another page of advertising in print and you don't have any problem. So that ties into that. The other thing, by adding new products, we're able to increase our value to institutions and so increase our price to them. More products also means that we have more licensing capabilities and opportunities for people. We have our corridors, which we sell to individuals. We have sponsorship opportunities for distribution sponsorships. So there's a whole host of revenue opportunities for us, and that's what we're pursuing right now.
Yeah. Again, I'm sorry, I'm afraid this microphone's a placebo.
Yeah, I think it is, actually. Right.
Do you have any concise advice on what you'd be advising them to do other than come hear your talks?
Yeah, well, yeah, because the pay is great, let me tell you. let's see. I would learn this and take it to heart because, I mean, if you're, let's say, I'll pick up on cookbook. If you're a cookbook publisher, Epicurious is probably eating your lunch. And that's because it is digital, immediate, mobile, connected, personal, all of these things. If you're a children's book publisher, online games are probably eating your lunch or the biggest threat you're facing. So I think that there's a concept that comes from, I think it's Ian M. Banks, the Scottish author who writes the AI books. There's a book called Accession, and it's about what he calls the outside context problem. And it's essentially what the Mayans and the Aztecs faced when the Spanish conquistadors showed up on the shore with guns, germs, and steel, right? And there's really nothing you can do. It's just going to beat the living daylights out of you. And you just need to basically become a conquistador. That's the only way to win, you know? So I think that's a really hard lesson to take, is that there is just something superior and you can't fight it. And if you can't beat them, join them. I think that's the lesson. And that's what we've been trying to do, too. It's, you know, we can't change our audience. They have such huge expectation changes as far as how the world works. And if you don't fit into it, you're just gone. Just drop off the radar.
Yeah. Supervision of print journals.
Correct.
Do you see that disappearing soon, or is just going to shift onto e?
We're going to write it as long as it makes money.
Why is that?
Because we like money. Because we need money so we can pay for all the other cool stuff.
Why do you think actually print is still?
You know, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. I think it's still high prestige in the medical space, in the professional space. It's interesting. You look at the book market, and hardcover book sales are not falling off like paperbacks. E-books are eating paperbacks. They're not eating hardcover because they're still the same audience that's kind of loves the hardcover book. They'll buy that author right as soon as it's out. You know, they listen to the NPR. They get sold on the way home, and they're like on Amazon buying the hardcover right away. And they want to have what I consider to be the trophy case at home, right? They want the bookcase that shows every book they've killed and eaten. So I think there's still some prestige to print. I think that from an advertising standpoint, again, Mary Meeker, who does the internet trends every year, continues to find that it's overvalued by advertisers and that online's undervalued. That's changing. We're seeing that shift. Others are seeing that shift. So I don't think it's going to be here forever. And already the other thing that's happened to print is that it's been allocated. So one of the first things that I did when I joined New England Journal of Medicine, they used to publish a twice annual index this thick and mail it. It was $1 million a year in expense. And I said, have you heard of a search engine? So let's save $1 million. And so we just dropped it. Don't need to print that anymore. There's a lot at JBJS. We publish single article abstracts, and if you want the rest of it, if you want to drill, like we talked about earlier, you go online and drill. We're not going to print the whole article. We'll give you a big flavor of it. So print's being reallocated as it kind of drifts into some mode. Not completely gone. It'll be like AM radio, but it'll be definitely a minor player.
Do you see the use of the QR code as a way to effectively help this transition?
Yes. I do. Yep.
So, since we're still with the print, I guess, how does your subscription model work? Then, is there more to get print? Is it?
Right. So, our subscription model is basically subsidized control. We have some circulation agreements with people who pay us to provide it to their members. We do that, and then we have the circulation to sell the advertising against. That's pretty much how our print model works.
So, you get the online access.
Yes, it's bundled. Right. Online access is bundled. You can just buy it, but we're only rolling that out outside the United States because most of our ad base is in the U.S. as far as print. So it's part of the juggling act. So someday soon we'll probably change that. But better safe than sorry. Yep.
Back to the print again.
Yeah.
We work in education materials for law students. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I'm just wondering about that information as far as some of the research you did with
video. Right. Yeah, there's a great book, and I hope I can – I can't remember the name of it. But basically, there was a study and a really great book out of England 5 years ago about the print online learning differences. I'll try to look it up. If you want to drop me your card, I can send you the title. But what they basically found is that people are, for collaboration and learning, print is still superior because you can mark it up, you can interact with it, you remember spatially, I was a third of the way through, or it was in the left-hand column, and that's why layout's so important and PDFs are remaining important. But for storage, people are moving to digital. So they'll drop it onto their hard drive or they'll store it in, you know, some sort of URL bank that they have or something, they'll bookmark it. They won't store it physically, but they'll use it and collaborate with it. So a lot of times that's why people bring printouts to meetings still and such, because it is more effective. But I'll try to recall the name of that book. Yeah, it's very good.